you're going to be like, I don't know if I want my doll learning from me.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Make it. Make the pasta. Make it. Make it. Make the pasta. Come on, let's go.
How can she want? They both are starch. Maybe I should make a mashed potato for on the other side.
Primo, look, don't, okay? Because they are the first customer to come in 2 hours. The fucking pipes
are... No. She's a criminal. I want to talk to her.
Hello, everybody. It's Recotopia, episode 48. I'm Chris Atkinson.
I'm Jeremy Scott.
And welcome to all of you out there in Twitch and YouTube who are watching us today on a Tuesday live as we go through our podcast today. It is Big Night from 1996, and it'll be fun to talk about this. I had not seen this movie since it came out, I don't think. So, it was good. But how are you doing today, Jeremy?
I'm doing excellent. I'm excited to talk about The Big Night and all the other small recommends and interact with our chat friends. And it's gonna be great.
All right. All right. Well, what? Speaking of those small recommends, what do you got? What do you got?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I'm going to start you out with a real chipper, crowd-pleasing, fun movie called Zodiac.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Many of you have probably seen Zodiac, but it is, in my opinion, probably one of the lesser seen by the masses David Fincher movies. and I think everybody's seen Fight Club. I think everybody's seen Seven. But Zodiac is one that may have fallen through the cracks for some people. And it's an interesting movie. This has been on, I think, Stars or Showtime recently. And I've caught bits and pieces of it all throughout the week. And I'm fascinated by this movie because it's structurally, it shouldn't work. It spans like 6 years. It's got like too many protagonists. And it's almost in parts. And yet it somehow works because to date, the Zodiac killer has not been found, named. This has not been solved. And I think that's what drives this entire film. The investigation ruins the lives of everyone that touches. Robert Downey Jr. Is a pretty great news reporter at the beginning. By the end, he's on all kinds of drugs and alcohol and strung out and just a very scary kind of situation. Jake Gyllenhaal loses, I think, at least one wife and custody of his kids. I think he begins the movie divorced with a separate kid. He's a cartoonist, man. He's a cartoonist who not only gets obsessed about it, but ends up knowing as much about this case as almost anyone. The real life person he's playing has published 2 books. Those books were largely the basis of this screenplay. This is a creepy ass movie, man. There's something about the way he shoots the kills that is unsettling as fuck. I could watch Michael Myers stab somebody into the wall with a knife 100 times and not be as disturbed as I am by that daylight knifing in the park on a hill. It's just, if you've not seen Zodiac, I can't recommend it enough. If you like Fincher movies, this is great. If you like murder mystery, this is great. All the performances are great. It's shot on this special camera that makes it look like it was really shot in the 70s. I just love it. And I've rediscovered my love for this movie this past week, so I wanted to share that on.
And there's another scene in there, too, where I think it's Jake Gyllenhaal goes to see a guy who used to be in the movie industry or something like that. He has a bunch of posters or so. I can't remember what it is. Is that what
he goes to see this guy's house. Yes, he's in this guy's basement, and he's like, listen, so I think it's this guy who's the Zodiac, because the fingerprint on these posters matches the letters. And the guy was like, well, he never lettered the posters. I did that.
Yeah. And
there's this sense of, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And we, he can't get out right away, but he wants to. And ultimately, by the time he gets to the front door, he's running. He's just bolts out the front door.
Such a great scene.
It's incredible. It builds the tension.
I wouldn't be surprised if this was a big recommend at some point. In fact, I think it's run across my head to make it a big recommend. But I know your love of this movie. So I may be holding out for you to big recommend it at some point, because this would be a great deep dive type movie. I got to watch more movies than average over the past week. So finally have a good stable of things, and I don't have to like say, hey, Avatar Way of Water is decent. I watched a movie in theaters this past week that I really, really enjoyed, and it seems like a lot of people are enjoying. Megan. Yet another, you know, AI is going to kill us, exhibit 3,245,000 or whatever. This movie, you've seen the trailer, so it's like, is this a comedy or is it a horror movie? And I think it's a comedy more than it's a horror movie. But it does have horror elements, in it. Just like any horror movie, I was sitting there going, man, this is like when we were back doing the October, movies, and it seemed like everybody's parents were, or kids were dying in a car crash at the beginning of the movie. This time, the little girl in this movie, her parents die in a car crash while she's in the backseat. We are introduced right off the bat, Verhoeven style, RoboCop style, with this commercial for a pet that never dies. Basically, it's a robot pet that will always be with you, and there's seven different kinds and blah blah blah, and it's told in that very like kind of a scary manner in a way, because you're like wow, we really put a commercial like this. It's kind of just off kilter enough to be like, wow, that's fucked up. her parents die. Her mom's sister, played by Allison Williams, is someone who works at a toy company, and she's trying to come up with the latest greatest toy that all the kids will want. And one of the prototypes they're working on is these lifelike dolls that interact with you and learn from you at the same time to become better companions and things like that. I know immediately your eyebrows should be like, if you ever hear this in the real world, you're going to be like, I don't know if I want my doll learning from me. So there are a couple of failures at the beginning, and Allison Williams is not ready to be like a guardian to her niece and everything. She's very dedicated to work, and she's actually kind of looking for a way to have someone babysit for her while she does her work at the same time. And so a couple of things culminate in the fact that she's able to she's able to finally come up with a prototype that actually works the way that that she wants it to. And she introduces it to her niece. And yes, this doll immediately starts like saying all the right things, but there's a hilarious opening, a bonding moment between her and the real girl that you're like in a lesser movie, it would be horrible. It would absolutely throw the movie completely out of whack, and you would not be able to think about it. You wouldn't be able to think anything. It really takes the right deft touch to come off with a scene like that and do it well. Obviously the doll is learning from the daughter, but something that the movie, I don't think the movie's saying that these are inherently evil. I think they're saying something happens. I don't want to get too spoilery or anything, but they're saying something happens to the doll that makes it start to become evil and everything. You say, here's your problem. Someone switched this thing to evil, you know? they're saying something happened to it, and that's where the doll starts doing like ultra creepy things. But man, There are so many funny moments in this. There are many scary moments too, but it's don't forget to laugh throughout this whole thing. It's just one of those type of movies. It made like 30 million domestic,
big ass
over the weekend. And I think this should be most people's alleys.
I feel like every year there's a horror movie that for whatever reason, everybody just decides without planning, we're going to that. Like a few years back, I remember it was a very similar feeling to now with this, when It Follows came out and it was like suddenly everybody was talking about It Follows. This is a big hit already, and I bet they're gonna make a sequel.
Oh yeah,
tomorrow.
Yeah, definitely.
Good stuff. My second small recommend is a television show that I remember seeing a trailer for years ago and then forgot. And because I don't watch network television, did not know it had come and has had three seasons already. This is a show called Lego Masters, and it's on Fox.
Seen an episode of this. Mm-hmm.
And it's hosted by Will Arnett. And I have very recently gotten a little bit into Legos. My family gave me, I think I tweeted about it, my family gave me the Friends Lego set of the Central Perk coffee shop with all the little mini figurines of the Friends. It's up here on my shelf. My wife and I spent like 5 hours putting that together, and it was really fun. And then I think I saw a tweet about Lego Masters, and I was like, oh, I remember they were going to do a show about people doing Legos. That's what this is. I've only seen three episodes. It's on Hulu. It's also on Tubi for free if you don't want to stick with the network schedule. And I have some gripes, but this is a really fun show of teams of Lego builders competing in challenges. It's like Top Chef for Legos. So the very first one is they have to build a theme park. And one of the specs of the challenge is you have to have a moving, working ride. And once that was said, I was like, okay, all of these people are on a different level than I am. And almost all of them built a moving working carnival ride with Legos, and I'm like, wow, what the hell? The only downside, and this is because it's a network show, I think something like Netflix or Prime would be a little bit more naturalistic. They script all this cheesy shit for Will Arnett to say and do, and it like little skits even sometimes, and it's absolutely maddening. It's like I'm coming back from a commercial break and the show recaps 30 seconds of what you already saw before the commercial break. It's just maddening. There's the second episode, he says, all right, he calls the Lego builders together and he goes, all right, this second episode, now this is where you would think we'd bring out a big celebrity guest. And they get all excited. And he's like, but we're not going to do that. And they're like, oh. And he's like, except we are. And I'm like, that was 30 seconds that has nothing to do with Legos. And I like Will Arnett. Yeah. I really do. But he's the problem with this show. And it's not him. It's the role that they put him in to be this, like, he feels compelled to be funny. He makes terrible puns. But if you can get past that, which I can. The Lego and the building aspect of it is really super fun. So that's Lego Masters. It's on Fox. Just got renewed for a fourth season, and they did a Christmas special, a two-parter or something too.
I believe that's one of the episodes that I actually saw. I was in New York and was in a hotel room, and that came on, and I watched that one of those episodes. One of them got Leslie Jordan in it, I believe. It's
so interesting.
I thought it was pretty fun. I didn't get a chance to watch it all the way through, but yeah, it looked really good. So I imagine if you were a Top Chef kind of guy, you know, you would like a show like this that gets people into these competitions and, you know, they make really cool things with the limited amount of resources and so on and so forth. So
yeah, like I completed one set and I'm like, I'm a Lego guy. And like these guys are taking raw pieces, thousands of them, and constructing their own thing. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I had the movie night with friends over the past weekend, and it was my turn to choose. So I picked two movies I had never seen before. One of them was a Stanley Kubrick film called Paths of Glory from 1957.
Wow.
This stars Kirk Douglas. It's probably largely the reason why Kubrick ends up being hired to be on Spartacus later on. Paths of Glory is about a French, like it's the French side in the, I'm gonna be really ignorant here and say it was World War One. I think it was World War One. I hope it was World War One. And the very opening part of this movie, somebody from the government comes down to a general and says, "We need you to take what is known as the anthill." And this is at a moment where they're, you know, in the war where there's a lot of like, you know, there's not a lot of like advancement going on. People are like hiding in bunkers, and you know, every time they do try to make an advance, they usually get destroyed if they try to do it, because it's just that kind of thing. And at this point, when they ask this general to do this, the general's like, "Oh my God, man, we only have like 8,000 people down there. There's like no way we'll be able to take this anthill." And the guy's like, "I know you can do it, and we'll be able to reward you handsomely once you get you that promotion that you want or whatever, if you can do this." So the general is motivated to go and tell his next lower down that they need to take the anthill. And his next lower down is Kirk Douglas playing this guy. It's kind of weird seeing a French army being played by like a bunch of people speaking regular English all the way through, but you know, it's whatever. But so they're told that they need to do this, and they're like, dude, like you can see it. Kubrick does a really good job of taking us through these bunkers. There's people just, they're tired, they're dirty, they're of course super injured. You see people with like bandages all over their bodies being taken through. There's people who are just, you know, there are people who are shell-shocked. At the time they're calling it shell shock, not PTSD. They're all demoralized and whatever, and there's very few of them left at this point to do a major attack like this. And Kirk Douglas is like, "Man, there's no way we can do this. We can't take the anthill. We can't do that. There's no way. There's no way to go and do that." And they're like, this is sort of like, well, you're going to do it. Basically, it doesn't matter whether you think you can do it or not. You're going to do it. So they do their best charge. Basically, it's as good as it's going to get. And they get to another bunker, and it's basically like, if we run any further, we're just going to die. There's no sense in this. It's clear as day. You're going to die if you run any further than this. And so they all decide not to attack the anthill. So the next half of this movie is the French government trying to find somebody to blame for not going towards the anthill. They pick three people at random to get punished for this, just so that they can have something in front of, you know, the French press that says, "These guys were cowards. We wanted to have an advance, and these people are the reason that you were let down." Basically, Kirk Douglas decides to be the lawyer for the soldiers in this. It's pretty clear that there's no way that he's going to get anything that he wants in this. He's not going to be able to call witnesses. He's not going to be able to do any kind of history, nothing. The point for them, and even though it's clear as day to anybody who's watching this, the point for them is just to make somebody, is just to set an example. And you can see that right off the bat. There's no real defense here, even though everybody knows that if they had run any further, everybody would have died. They need to get punished for whatever they did. So the movie is a very short hour and a half, believe it or not. It is a war movie. Wow. That is an hour and a half. It has like a good first half of like war stuff, and then another half of courtroom type of stuff. And it has a lot of good drama there towards the end as well. If you want to see Kubrick sort of becoming Kubrick, this movie is not like a lot of the stuff that you see, like starting with 2001, but you can definitely see the director that's emerging from this movie. And this movie is excellent. It is extremely good. So highly recommend it. Paths of Glory, 1957.
All right. I Googled while you were talking, and it's got some raves over on the Rotten Tomatoes area. Mm-hmm. So a really high score. So that sounds like one to check out, and it is one of the Kubrick I have not seen. So, All right.
Time for the big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The big Kapow recommend, 1996, Big Night. This was directed by Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott. They're both in the movie. And Stanley Tucci is one of the primary characters. They would go on to make a couple other films together in various capacities. There's one with Oliver Platt, who's a producer here, on a boat with Stanley Tucci, and it's like vaudeville era. Why am I rambling about that? Anyway, so Big Night is about two Italian brothers, Primo and Secondo. Secco, as they call him. Some of the least creative names I have ever seen, although that may be common in Italian culture. They own a restaurant on the Jersey Shore. It's an Italian restaurant. Food is exquisite because Tony Shalhoub, his brother Primo, is the chef, and he's just incredible. He's got all this old world skill and knowledge about flavors. And we open on a dinner service where there's essentially two tables, a single person, a man who appears to come here regularly, and then a couple who I wonder why they're even in here in the first place. Mm-hmm. But they don't like how awesome this food is because they're stupid and they don't understand what risotto is. So they send back the risotto for spaghetti and meatballs. Secondo is the front of the house, essentially. He definitely can't cook, but he's the business managing side of this, and he also waits tables when necessary. Mark Anthony is their waiter, Cristiano. And so they butt heads because it's clear that they've been butting heads about this for years because Stanley Tucci wants to make practical, sensible decisions, make money, have the restaurant thrive. Whereas Primo is just a hardliner for the quality of the food. There's a conversation that later happens that highlights this where Secondo says, what if we took the risotto off the menu? Mm-hmm. It takes you a really long time to make. You can't do anything else while you're making it because it requires your attention. That makes it really expensive, and the people here don't understand it. And I can't remember exactly what Primo says, but he's something like, why don't we, people will love this. I got an idea. And so Stanley Tucci sits down all excited and Tony Shalhoub's like, what are we, hot dogs? Just give them hot dogs. basically saying, you know, we're going to keep doing the risotto. Across the street, Ian Holm owns a very successful Italian restaurant that we are led to believe serves bland, average Italian food and steaks. But Ian Holm is fucking delightful in this movie.
Yes, he is.
He's just breathing charm and life into this character. Stanley Tucci goes to see him one night, and he's giving him a pep talk about, you know, getting his restaurant going again. And he's like, bite your teeth into the ass of life. And he tells him the story about Humphrey Bogart and how Humphrey Bogart came through town. And so Ian Holm's playing a character named Pascal. Pascal sent a bottle of really awesome alcohol with a handwritten note to Humphrey Bogart. And lo and behold, two nights later, Humphrey Bogart walks into Pascal's restaurant. And then he comes back several years later when he's in town again. And he basically advises Tucci to try this same approach to save his restaurant and promises to call Louis Prima, a famous Italian-American singer, to come to town to eat at his restaurant. And that will provide enough buzz and word of mouth to take the Paradise, their restaurant, into the next stratosphere. There's a scene where he goes to the banks, Secco does, and basically finds out not only can you not get any more loans, but if you can't pay something by Friday or next week, I think it's just the end of the month, they're going to foreclose. So things are really, really dire. And of course, he hasn't told his brother Primo that this is things are this bad. He's also sleeping with two women, or at least making out with one, and sleeping with another. Minnie Driver plays Phyllis. She works at the bank. That's his technical girlfriend. But then privately, he's sleeping with Isabella Rossellini, who is Pascal's wife. That is obviously messy. They start planning this meal. They decide to do this big night dinner. They're going to blow it out. He invites his girlfriend. He invites Pascal and his wife. Of course, Louis Prima is coming. He ends up test driving a Cadillac. Everybody in this movie loves Cadillacs. And Campbell Scott is the auto dealer. He invites that guy to dinner. He says, park your car out in front of my restaurant and I'll give you a free meal. He invites a reporter in to do a story about Louis Prima. He goes to the flower girl that Primo secretly loves and invites her. And so you end up with this large
Allison Janney.
Allison Janney, pre-West Wing. Gosh, I also forgot to tell you, Liev Schreiber is playing the doorman at Pascal's restaurant. He has like two lines. It's fun to see how fame works like that.
Yeah.
Because Allison Janney was not particularly famous at this point. West Wing made her famous. She was obviously, she's really good in this movie. She's obviously had talent.
And Liev Schreiber, he's not going to be famous until like the next year, but like he's going to be in Scream a little bit in the same year. And then the next year is when he really starts to take off. But anyway.
Yeah. So there are so many great montages in this movie. This movie does montages as well as any movie I've ever seen. There's a montage opening of them making pasta for the big night. One of the first things they do is they make pasta. They roll it out. It's only their hands that we see in this lively Italian music, and they cut it into squares, and then they're using this little device to roll it into rigatoni-looking things. And then we get to the party. We get to the dinner, and I want to jump through the screen and be at this dinner. I'm not 100% sure what gets the bulk of the credit, whether it's the acting, the music, the directing. It just feels like one of the funnest, most delicious. They dance around in a conga line. Everybody's just having a ball. And then it all comes crashing down. When it's realized that Louis Prima isn't going to come. Actually, it doesn't crash down then. Secco says, well, let's just eat. Let's just serve the food to everybody. And it is amazing looking food. This movie is food porn on acid. I would advise you eat before you watch this movie. And then everything breaks down. Secco is caught by his girlfriend kissing Pascal's wife. She runs out. Pascal's wife decides to leave, but before she leaves, she decides to basically embarrass her husband completely and tell the whole room that he never even called Louis Prima. Louis Prima was never coming. And Pascal's a dick, like, for real. Everybody ends up on the beach because Secco's trying to chase Phyllis. She comes out of the ocean and basically says, I'm done with you forever. I think she says, I'm not even here, and walks away. And then the brothers have a knockdown drag out where Primo comes and tells Secco, hey, Louis Prima was never coming. He lied to us. I called our uncle last week in Rome. We've got an offer to go cook for him in Rome. And that is just the chisel that breaks them wide open. And Tucci says, you go. You know, I'm going to stay here. I want to see through what we started. I want to succeed. I don't want to go crawling back to where we came from. And of course, Primo just wants to make good food. He doesn't really care where he is.
Yeah.
And everybody's devastated and wanders off on their own. And then the final scene of the movie, which is maybe one of my favorite final scenes in any movie.
Pretty fucking fantastic.
He comes in, Secco does, into the kitchen. Cristiano's sleeping on the table. He says, you hungry? That's the last line of the movie. He gets down a frying pan, he cracks three eggs, he throws a little olive oil in the pan and a pinch of salt in the eggs, and then he puts the eggs into the pan It's not really an omelet, but it's not really scrambled eggs. It's just really fluffy omelet scramble. There's no ingredients. It's eggs and salt. Mm-hmm. And it's so simple. And everything they cooked for the big meal was so complex. And yeah. I love how this is an opportunity to show that simple food, you know, his perspective is not wrong. We don't have to do this big fancy risotto, timpano stuff. We can make really quality food with three goddamn eggs. Mm-hmm. Splits it between him and Cristiano, and then Primo comes stumbling in, and they acknowledge each other with looks. And then Secco goes and gets another plate and puts the last little bit of eggs on that and sets it down. Primo grabs a chair and comes over, and they put their arms around each other as they mm-hmm. eat their eggs.
Yeah.
And I had not seen this movie in maybe 16, 17 years. I'd seen it twice before this, but it was just long enough that all of this was new to me again. And I sure hope you didn't hate it, because I thought it was delightful. I really, really loved watching this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you think? Yeah, I saw this either back in 1996 or probably the year after when it came on video and things like that. But yeah, this movie's really good. That ending, that last scene is just a magical thing, because it's, without saying a word, Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub have made up after their fight. And it's all because he just made some eggs. He does all of that in real time, and it looks like it's all in one shot.
Yep.
It's just fun seeing him just come over and crack eggs and just start whipping it up into that little bowl, and then sprinkling a little salt on it, and then put it in the pan. You see it cook in real time. You see Mark Anthony sit there, and he's like watching him. He brings the bread over, all that, and then they're both eating. Then Shalhoub comes in, and it's a great, great scene. Yeah, I think this is a problem of a lot of, when you have immigrants come over who want to give an authentic style recipe, a menu and everything like that. The authentic that people, clamor for or say they really want is a lot of fool's gold, I think, a lot of times, because Americans especially like to put extra things in their in these international dishes to make them, taste better or taste them more like their taste. So a lot of these authentic quote unquote restaurants that come in, they just start making stuff that they know that Americans will eat, even though it's really kind of a bastardized version of the original thing. And you're right. These two people at the beginning of the movie who are sitting there, like, I don't know why they got in there. Maybe they represent these kind of people who are like, I really want to have something authentic. And they think that the authentic means that it's going to be just prepared the same way as always, but it tastes a little bit better because it's, whatever. There's something that they're missing and all that. And risotto. Yeah, this woman breaks it down. I was like, you said there would be shrimp and stuff in there. I don't see shrimp or anything. And it's like, and it's all just the risotto is a different kind of rice. It's it's a lot of different things that they're not prepared for. I don't know does she send the risotto back, because I think she just asked for spaghetti in addition to.
I don't know that she sends it back. Yeah, she's asking for a side. There's a point where
they go back into the kitchen, and Stanley Tucci's like, I want you to make a spaghetti and meatballs. And then Shalhoub is like, I want to know who I'm making this for. And he's like, you're making it for the woman out there. He's like, the risotto. And he's like, that's another starch. He's like, I don't know. Maybe she likes starch. Go ahead and make it. And he goes, why don't I just make her a baked potato for a side as well? Whatever. So like, but yeah, I think that's a thing that just generally happens a lot, especially in the United States, because we're always like, we want to put lots of cheese and things, and we want to put a lot of actually, that's funny. That's exactly what that dude, the other dude does when Tucci's sitting there, like, shaving the cheese on the whatever he's got. he gets done and he's like, oh no more. Yeah. And he just keeps
like three times.
He does it like three different times. But yeah, the whole trying, you know, yes, it's one of the, I think it's something that happens with a lot of businesses in general. You can be as authentic, you can be as genuine, you can be the best, but unless people have like a base of knowledge of how those dishes are prepared and what they look like and whatever, you're never going to get a mass of people come in. That's what's so heartbreaking about the reporter that they have there, because he says at the end, he's like, I was here to cover Louis Prima being at a new restaurant and he didn't show up, so there's no article anymore, you know, even though there is an article in there about how great this food was, but it's not like that's going to be on the front page or you know, you're not going to be like, had a great meal at a restaurant, unless you're like a food critic of some sort. And so that was what was so, that's what's so sad about it. I do like all these relationships that he has, Stanley Tucci has throughout this movie, all the people he interacts with. The Ian Holm character is great. His accent may be terrible, but like just the fucking guy, you know, I love all of that. And he does really sink his teeth into that. I'd forgotten that he was sleeping around in this, that in me with Minnie Driver, he's like just doing like the bare minimum or whatever, I guess, to have a girlfriend. And then with Isabella Rossellini, he's actually having sex with her.
Yeah.
But it really creates this atmosphere for what is leading up to this big night. He gets all these different, characters building up to be invited. Like everybody, I think, that is shown in the film ends up at that big night. I think everybody, right? Like everybody that's interacted with in the movie ends up there. Like you wouldn't think that you wouldn't really think that the car dealer is going to be there, but he's there.
Yeah.
And, I think this movie is just building up to, something that we've lost a lot of, I think, especially here, making food about a social experience and like making and taking your time with it and creating and having standards when it comes to creating these things. And so the reason why you want to jump into the screen and everything is like, yes, they are having the time of their lives. I bet when they're shooting this, they're having the time of their life.
Yeah.
It looks like there's some things in here that they've cut in. There's some scenes with Alice and Janney at the table and everything. I bet it has nothing to do with the movie at all. Like they just put a camera on her and they just started having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And they just cut that scene in there and it looks like it's part of this big, you know, this big night.
I also love how those two actors, they actually do some of the kitchen stuff. Like the omelet, obviously Stanley Tucci's doing that. Earlier in the movie, he takes a garlic clove and smashes it with his knife and rapidly dices it. And I wouldn't be surprised if they both came into the film with some culinary experience. But you know, there are the montages of just the hands that, but probably not them. But there's authenticity there. I think that's part of the reason that final scene is shot the way it is, so that, you know, we're really seeing him actually do that. And I love that. Nobody in this movie doubts his food. Even Pascal, who's trying to screw him over so he can hire him because he's that good of a cook. The newspaper guy who says, yeah, I can't write this article anymore, but you're right. This was the best meal ever. Like everybody knows this guy is awesome at cooking. It's just, how do we turn that into a successful restaurant? And honestly, as the movie ends, I don't know that they will. I don't know that they can, but what I know is that he's not going to go work for Pascal whatever he does, because that guy fucked him over.
I'd read that Campbell Scott and Stanley Tucci went to the same drama school or film school or something like that. That's the reason why I when I first started watching this, I was like, how did Campbell Scott and Stanley Tucci end up co-directing this movie? Like, just I had forgotten that they both directed this. And through that, for some reason, is the first time I realized, like, was I through this research was the first time this is, if you knew this, I'm sorry, this blew my mind that Campbell Scott is George C. Scott's son. I had no idea.
I had no idea either.
Yeah, like that had never been a part of like Campbell Scott's resume that I had ever seen before. And I was like, well, I guess that would make sense, but there's so many Scotts and there's like whatever. Like I didn't think. But yeah, the one of the interesting stories out of this was that they had an actress to play Phyllis, and I believe it was Mary Louise Parker was supposed to be in this role at one point. And apparently Minnie Driver was coming in to promote a movie. I'm going to guess it was like Circle of Friends or something like that was what she was probably promoting at the time. And she was talking with her agent about next movies that she might do or whatever. And apparently wherever they were to do this promotion, they heard these two people just screaming at each other, apparently. And it was Campbell Scott and Stanley Tucci. Huh. And they were yelling at each other, I guess, because one of their actresses had pulled out, and I guess it was Mary Louise Parker. And she just so happened to be in this movie. I thought that was really, really interesting. So
that is interesting. That's wild. Yeah, I also read that MGM was going to distribute the film, but wanted them to change the ending. And they held their ground and refused, and I'm glad they did. Probably cost them a lot of money.
I mean, I guess the ending that they wanted would have been they open up, the restaurant becomes successful or something like that. I understand if you're an executive and you're looking for money more than you're looking for like quality or whatever. I mean, it's almost what the movie's about.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're sitting there and you're like, oh, I don't know, there's not a feel good ending to this. There's like, I mean, it's kind of it's a feel good. It's a human feel good ending for sure.
Yes.
But like, it's not the success ending. Like we're supposed to have, this is an American success story. This is supposed to be, you know, like, you know, they're supposed to be popular at the end. And Ian Holmes' character, he should be out of business by the end of this movie. And like, everybody's going to this restaurant and whatever. Yeah, I wouldn't want to change that either.
I mean, he loses everything. He loses both girls. The restaurant's probably going to close, but he still has his brother. That's the point of the whole movie to me, is that their relationship is there's, even when they fight, there's clear love there. Mm-hmm. That's what I take away from the movie, is that, you know, his American dream might be falling apart, but what's stronger than that is the bond they have together. I don't think they're going to start serving mac and cheese with cut up hot dogs in it.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I think we need to move on to the next phase, and that is our double feature of the week.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
This was super hard for me. Obviously I'm going to give you, you know, the trademark other answers that are not going to be the answer, but
that's my favorite.
But I went through a lot of this going, well, maybe chef, you know, chef is another one of these, you know, small business food preparing movies, whatever.
Yeah.
I saw someone in the chat come up with the menu, and I like the parallels that they're talking about with the menu there. Mm-hmm. That would be an excellent double feature for this. Mm-hmm. I went through a bunch of food based things for a while, and then I was like, okay, I want to think this more about businesses, like when you're starting a business and whatever. Now, the really offbeat one, the one that I'm still not going to use, but would be a good one under the same theme, would be Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters would be an excellent double feature with this, if you're just talking about businesses trying to start up and whatever. Another one went along the lines of theater. The movie Noises Off, was something that I thought of, and I think was like going to be the definite one that I came up with at one point, but then I stayed in the theater and I said, Waiting for Guffman.
Oh,
movie that I want to pair up with this one. Because it's the same kind of deal. It's a theater troupe that want to put on this great production, expecting a critic to come and see it and to push them into star status.
That's beautiful.
In the movie. So I ended up with Waiting for Guffman here. I think that would be a pretty good double feature for this. And if you guys have never seen Waiting for Guffman,
oh my God,
that is a really, really funny movie starring Christopher Guest of This Is Spinal Tap fame. Mm-hmm. And he directs it a lot. And he's, there's just a million people, of course, Best in Show and all those movies, all those, if you're familiar with the Christopher Guest stuff, this was the first one of those after This Is Spinal Tap that they did. But anyway, yeah, that's what I ended up on. I was like, I was 100% going to do Noises Off for a long time. And I think just somewhere, just thinking about this theater thing, the Waiting for Guffman, I was like, oh yeah. Cause they're trying to get a critic to like, trump them up at the end.
Anyway. Yeah. That's beautiful. I didn't think of that one. I was thinking you might go with The Menu, just because there are not only just the title cards for each course of the meal, but there are parallels between the two main chefs in both of those movies and Demanding Standards. And I also just read yesterday, and I think this is relevant, that the most famous restaurant in the world, considered the best restaurant in the world, Noma, which I think is in Copenhagen, is closing after 2 decades. And the guy that runs it is considered the most innovative chef in the world. And he's saying we have to rethink fine dining because it's too hard. It's too much work. And we're burning out all of our kitchen staff by asking them to work all these extra hours and I feel like, having just watched The Menu, I felt like maybe this guy just watched The Menu and realized this, we can't keep doing it. So he's going to turn it into a test kitchen where he keeps innovating food that, and other chefs can come in and innovate. He's just not going to serve the food to anybody anymore because he thinks that fine dining has to have a seismic shift to a new model.
I mean, if you think about the entertainment we've seen in the past couple of years, where you have the Bear, and you have The Menu. There's a couple others. There's a movie I'm trying to come up with that has Stephen Graham in it that I just recently saw. That it's all in one shot. It's called Boiling Point. You see all of these different shows and movies we've seen, they all talk about like how tough it is to be in the restaurant business. Like, you know, the pressure, the amount of hours that you're working, the drug use, all of that type of stuff is being covered in everything that I've seen in the past 3 or 4 years. It's insane how many of these have come out. And yeah, I mean, it's I don't doubt it. I mean, to make that kind of quality food for exacting standards for everybody, not only your boss, but the people who are eating it and whatever. God, I wouldn't want to do it. That's for sure.
No, I'll be curious to see how that impacts the rest of the world.
Pig Jagged said Pig is another one that's another one that talks about the pressures of all of that. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I think that Waiting for Guffman is a fantastic double feature. Good pick. Mm-hmm. You continue to surprise me. And what is next week's homework?
A movie that I thought that got totally passed by because of the 2020 pandemic. And, you know, we're still in a pandemic, so I hate calling it the pandemic. But I think everybody knows what we mean when we say the pandemic 2020. Another Round is the movie that I want to put on everybody. I watched this, we were doing our best of 2020, and this movie came up in the listing that Aaron sends us every year. And it stars Mads Mikkelsen. It's just one of these, it's one of these movies that I just think it got just, I don't know, it just got completely glossed over. It may have gotten some Oscar nominations for something. I don't know. I don't know if it did or not, but it's about four teachers who read a quote about how much alcohol you should have in your system at any one time and be functional. And they try to test this theory, trying to be the, you know, to have the, just the right amount in their system while they're teaching their classes. Obviously some go too far and some don't do it enough and so on and so forth. It's a grand experiment, but it's a very funny movie. Some, a lot of drama in it as well. I only saw it the one time in 2020, but I remember it being great and not very many people talking about it. So I wanted to revisit this movie because, it's one of those that's in danger, I think, of not being, you know, of being forgotten, so to speak, even though it's got a very high rating on the IMDb. I think you can watch this movie on Hulu.
You can. And seeing the poster here, I know I read about this or saw this poster 2 years ago, but when you said the name of the movie, I was like, ooh, is it a golf movie? Because I'd completely forgotten about it. And sorry, my computer just made a loud noise for some reason in my ears. Yeah, that's on Hulu. If you have a premium subscription on Roku, you can also watch it. Somebody in the comments said it's on Canopy. I think that is the library-based streaming service that you can access with a library card for free. Another round is next week's homework, and I have never seen it, so I'm excited to get into it.
And yeah, I figured you probably hadn't, and I was kind of excited to finally get a movie that one of us hasn't seen. There may be a time I have a wild hair and try to get one that both of us haven't seen. that's not some contemporary movie that we had to watch, whatever, but this one I was fairly certain you hadn't seen, and I don't hear enough about it, and I think it's a great movie. So anyway, looking forward to rewatching that one.
I am down. Let's get to a question or two before we head to lunch.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Recently you answered a question about movies that had terrible titles but were actually great. What are some movies with great titles that are actually bad?
Okay. So the first one that came to mind was Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
yes.
Which is based on a book, obviously, but it's one of the worst movies that you'll ever watch. Yeah, it is. The Men Who Stare at Goats. I don't know if that's it's a kind of a crazy title. It may not be a great title, but it's certainly tells you that there's a movie that you're like, that this is going to be, sounds like it's going to be a lot better than what it ends up being when you watch it. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. I thought that was a good title. Movie's terrible. I hate it. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
That's another one. Yeah. That sounds amazing to me. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And it's terrible.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. My answers are lame. You like picked actual titles that would intrigue. I picked Cloud Atlas because I think that... It's an intriguing title, at least. Cloud Atlas. Okay, that sounds interesting. And I've seen this film 5 or 6 times at this point, and it just no longer. I can't make it good. Now it's just getting worse every time I see it. But for the first 3 viewings, I was like, I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this.
Yeah.
So I will go with Cloud Atlas, but I really think the Crystal Skull is the best answer.
Over in the comments, we've got, I think people are maybe having a laugh with Sin City, since it's our mascot terrible movie here. Jet Smith says Crash. Shaggy Nut says The Gods Must Be Crazy. I don't know if that movie's bad. I haven't seen that movie in forever. The Gods Must Be Crazy.
I haven't seen it.
It's like a Coke bottle lands in this, like, I think it's in this African tribe, whatever, and they I don't know. That's all I remember is the Coke bottle. But I just remember it being, I thought it was kind of funny. Anyway, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Yeah. epic movie the day after. I actually thought about The Day After Tomorrow, and I was wondering, is that a good title, or if is, or is that just like, you know, like that South Park did that episode where they were making fun of like the Day After Tomorrow. It's like, it'll be the day before The Day After Tomorrow.
You know, stuff like that. All right, let's do another one. Top Gun right. Maverick defied all the skepticism and turned out great. What other shaky sequels turned out great? My answer does not conform to the question. Go ahead, Chris.
Does it say shaky sequels?
It does, but that's not how I answered it.
Says what other years later sequels turned out to be great on my end. I don't know if it's a shaky.
How did mine sequel. Say shaky? All right. Well, yeah. I don't know. What other years later sequels turned years out great?
This one's really hard, by the way, because most of the time these movies are not very good. But I think Blade Runner 2049 yes! certainly fits that bill. Yes. I like it better than the original. Sorry.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I went with the mother of all years later sequels, and that's The Color of Money, which is a follow-up to The Hustler. Paul Newman is in both, but in the second one, he's like 40 years older. Mm-hmm. I like Color of Money. That's going to be a main recommend one of these days because that movie rules.
Yeah. Objective Sid says Aliens, which is a good one. That's that came out 7 years after the original Alien. That was interesting, right? The Alien came out in 1979, was a big hit. And then like it took them 7 years to come out with a sequel to that. I'm wondering what happened there. Yeah. I've never heard that story, because you would think that there'd be a sequel almost like 2 or 3 years later in this era of film.
Right.
So maybe it's, you know, and it's not, you can't say it's a Cameron thing, because Cameron didn't have the clout at that
right.
point to be like, I'm going to spend 7 years making the new Alien movie. He didn't have that kind of clout. So
anyway. Prey in the comments. That's an excellent answer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For Ghostbusters sure. Afterlife. I liked that movie. Toy Story 3. I understand that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. So next week will be another round, and we'd like to thank you guys for coming into the chat today on Twitch and YouTube. Mm-hmm. Thank you for contributing to the conversation. Always glad to see you guys. That's going to do it for this week.
See you guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Hey, man. All right. Hey, man.
Hey. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, man.
I don't even know what's going on.
I don't either. I just, I made a funny voice and I liked it, so I kept doing it.
Yeah. It's like a half Mitch Hedberg, maybe just half you.
My favorite scene in Horrible Bosses 2 is when they call Christoph Waltz and try and do cowboy voices.
Oh, yeah.
Looks like a grasshopper found himself a blade of grass to sit upon. Yep. And Christoph Waltz even says, okay, listen here, fake cowboys.
Yeah. Both times Nashville teams have made it far in the playoffs in the past, whatever, 5-6 years, there are teams that, like, you're just like, oh, no chance that they have. There's just no chance. Yeah. And well, for whatever reason, they're that team that comes in and just like gets a bunch of breaks, or they've found something that works in the playoffs. And so like Nashville was like that. They faced the Blackhawks in the first round. We're like, nah, you know, I mean, that's good. Yeah. Good job getting in the playoffs, guys. You're going to get swept by the Blackhawks. And then they swept the Blackhawks.
Yep.
And then they just kept going and kept going and kept going. And then the Titans a few years ago was another one of those teams where They made it to the AFC Championship and even had Kansas City on the ropes in the AFC Championship. And then Patrick Mahomes did his thing. But yeah. Still, those teams went way farther than any of us had any dream of them going. Following year, I feel like they made it past maybe Colorado or something like that in the first round. And then in the second round, they got dick punched by the Dallas Stars. And then the following year, they had maybe the best record. I'm trying to remember if that was there. Was that was a one and done? Because who
beat them?
Because that was 2019, and that was just before the 2020 year where they had the weird divisions because of the pandemic stuff.
Yeah, I went down a rabbit hole the other day. Speaking of hockey, trying to decide, because I made a casual reference to Patrick about Mario Lemieux, or he made a Mario Lemieux reference, and I said, "What's wild is that Sidney Crosby is arguably as good, if not better, than Mario Lemieux." And then afterwards, I started thinking, is that true? Because, and I think it is, ultimately, but I went down this rabbit hole, because this is hotly debated online, who's better, Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant or whatever. And it seems like most people give the edge to Lemieux for two reasons. He has a lot more points, but I don't know that greatness is solely about points.
Well, especially also, in the era in which Lemieux played, because...
Right.
Yeah.
Because the points were, aplenty. Mm-hmm. But he also took 3 years off. He just retired for 3 years.
Yeah.
And so when they line him up with Crosby, everybody's like, well, he had those 3 extra years where he wasn't even doing anything. And then I saw people giving Crosby extra credit for having Evgeny Malkin on his line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, does Jaromir Jagr not exist on Mario Lemieux's line for several years?
Yeah, exactly.
They both had a right-hand man that was almost as talented as they are. But it is wild, though. Pittsburgh fans don't know how good they got it in terms of hockey, because they've had the best player in the world on their team twice now.
I have I've heard from a couple of big time hockey people that they think Connor McDavid is the best player they've ever seen.
Yeah, and I just think he needs the time to prove that statistically. But when I have seen him play, he's like no one else I've ever seen.
He's faster got the than everybody. Speed.
He's bigger than everybody.
He's bigger than everybody. He like does a lot of creative stuff with the puck. I mean, it's just insane watching him.
It is frustrating that Carolina and Florida and like all these expansion teams, Vegas had like great runs in their first 3 or 4 years, and we didn't get that.
Yeah. Well, it's well, did Carolina have a great run in their first few years?
I think they did. I thought they won the cup. Maybe I'm thinking wrong.
Like, how long have they been in the league? Because they did win the cup, but it was in 2006, but I don't know how long they'd been in the league at that point.
Well, they were one of those, maybe this is the reason, they were one of those transfer teams.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that go into these, right? Like the Vegas Golden Knights got the most money to spend of any expansion team ever. So they had the best like expansion draft rules in their favor that anybody had ever had, I think. And
yeah,
and so they got like all these great players, and then they had all the money to spend, and so it was just like that's why they were good immediately.
Yep. Yeah, I was wrong. Carolina is not an expansion team, but they did go to the Cup Finals 5 years after going to North Carolina, which is not as fast as I remember.
They were Whalers. I mean, the Hartford Whalers.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the Panthers, Florida Panthers, went pretty quick after they were established. This is great radio. Everybody who loves hockey is enjoying these outtakes.
Yes.
Everybody who hates hockey is like, what?
All right, we're going to have to forward through this. Oh, they're still talking about hockey. I can talk about a movie that I'm not likely to recommend, but I may recommend just as a lark to you to watch at some point. I watched the most batshit insane horror movie I had ever seen it was on Criterion Channel. It's called House. It's a Japanese 1977 movie. And it's one of those where it's just got a lot of insanity right off the bat, just the way they're telling the story and how they cut and how they like just allow certain things to happen and whatever. But like, it's about, basically what it's about is this schoolgirl wants to go on a summer vacation to this, to her aunt's house. And she brings all of her buddies, and all of her buddies are named something that they're going to be known for in the movie. So like, one's named Kung Fu and one's named Prof, as in professor. One is, you know, it's like that. It's how it goes, the whole thing. But when they get into the house, all this stuff starts happening. They're using these weird practical, maybe first time digital effects and stuff like that. But like, somebody gets eaten by a piano. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. There are just moments of just like pure whimsy all the way through it. And it's hard to know whether to call it. It's more comedy than horror, but there's so many bizarre things that happen. And you just read the synopsis of this movie, you're going to be like, oh yeah, I need to see that. You know, it's because it's, I can't even do it justice. There's just, you know, somebody gets eaten by a piano. There's like, there's just weird stuff going on all the way through it. And it's just, it's sort of anything goes, all the way throughout. So anyway, you might enjoy that movie.